Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would you pay for a lump of ambergris? And more importantly, what could you do with it once you had it? For hundreds of years, this naturally occurring substance found mostly on beaches has been used as a remedy, a delicacy, and a fixative agent in some of the most costly, in some of the costliest perfumes on the planet. For much of that time, those who hunted it and traded it for exorbitant sums of money had no idea where it came from. They only knew it had properties unlike anything else. The 19th century discovery that ambergris is actually a rare form of sperm whale dung must have been a bit disheartening, but it's done nothing to make it less desirable. And molecular biologist and science writer Christopher Kemp tells the fascinating story in his new book, Floating Gold, A Natural and Unnatural History of Ambergris. Chris, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
So we have to talk about how this stuff comes into existence, because it's unlike any commodity I've ever heard of before. And it starts with the fact that squid beaks do not go down easy.
Well, that's right. Yeah. So basically, sperm whales are the only animals in the world that produce ambergris. And it's basically a product of their diet. The average male adult sperm whale is about 60 feet long, weighs about 50 tons, and consumes about a ton of squid a day just to maintain its weight. So these are enormous animals constantly churning through their energy stores. And in terms of their digestive system, they actually have a lot in common with ruminants like cows and goats and animals like that. So they basically have several stomach chambers. And so they're consuming these vast quantities of squid. And squid are basically mostly digestible, apart from their beak, which is it's a strange-looking thing. It actually resembles a parrot's beak more than anything else. And it's very hard and durable, and it's completely non-digestible. And so in a normal sperm whale, they will kind of regurgitate this non-digestible material every now and again into the ocean. And that's how it's supposed to work. But in a very small percentage, and it's estimated that it's probably about 1% of sperm whales, instead, some of these non-digestible squid beaks make it through the stomach chambers into the small intestine, where they start to kind of chafe and irritate the gut lining, which is really sensitive. And so in response to that, the sperm whale starts to secrete this very cholesterol-rich kind of material, which binds up all of the squid beaks and prevents them from irritating the gut. And that essentially is what then goes on to become ambergris. And so it's not quite correct to say that it's dung, but it is a form of dung. You know, it has a lot in common with feces, and anyone who has smelled really fresh black ambergris would tell you that certainly, you know, it has a lot in common with feces. Like, that's what it's really, the odor of it and the texture of it and everything else about it is really reminiscent of something like sheep dung. It's a very strange substance.
So can we assume that ambergris is the result of pretty significant distress on the part of the whale? I mean, is it uncomfortable if you happen to be one of the 1% of whales that produces this stuff?
You know, I think that's really something that can't be answered. You know, one of the most compelling things to me about ambergris and about sperm whales in general is that even though they're one of the largest animals on the planet, most of their lives are still complete mystery to us. They're enormous. You know, they're the size of several school buses. But as soon as they dive below the surface, they're pretty much lost to us. And there are huge aspects of their lives that we know very little about. They go on these enormous migrations, and we don't know particularly where they go or why they go there. We still don't know about really large aspects of how they hunt the squid and how they eat them, how they track them down, what their vocalizations are actually about, you know, just how social they are. And so I think the short answer would be, we just don't know whether ambergris causes them distress or discomfort. And, You know, I always say that nothing in the natural world is true all the time anyway, and so it would be, you know, I would probably assume that in some animals it actually kills them, and mm-hmm. so in those animals clearly there's some discomfort and it's actually a pathologic process, but no one really knows whether or not other members of that 1% that produce ambergris are actually able to just kind of pass it out and then carry on going. No one really knows.
So after the stuff is expelled into the ocean, that's only part of the process, because then it floats around for sometimes years at a time.
It's true, yeah. So, you know, it's kind of a mystery upon mystery, ambergris is, and to be expelled by a sperm whale is really just the start of its journey. And when it comes out, it's like, it's really black and sticky and fecal, and it's pretty unpleasant stuff. But it spends years and years, and people believe it's even decades, floating around on ocean currents, traveling vast distances. And over that time, it goes through a huge kind of transformative change, lots of molecular degradation. It changes from this black, sticky stuff to a white, resinous substance. It loses a lot of its water content, and it becomes like a completely different thing. Basically, if you've held a piece of fresh ambergris in your hand and a piece of this white, refined ambergris that has spent decades in the ocean, you'd almost think that they were completely different substances.
So what sorts of scents does finished ambergris give off? And you attempt multiple times in the book to sort of describe it, and it sounds like no two pieces are exactly alike.
Yeah, well, you know, there are several things that confuse any attempt to describe it. And one is that the smell of any piece of ambergris is really a reflection of the journey that it's been on. And so it's pretty safe to say that almost no two pieces have gone on the same journey.
Yeah.
And so there's a huge range of differences in the odor profile of different pieces of ambergris. And that's part of what I find really fascinating about it. And then the other aspect is that odor, like any other sense, is a really individual thing. And what I might pick up and smell when I'm trying to describe a piece of ambergris, that would be a reflection of all of the reference points that I would use for it. And you, with, you know, the life that you have lived and maybe your childhood and upbringing, it might cause you to think about something else entirely. So there are several kind of confounders when anyone is trying to describe ambergris. But even that being said, a lot of the descriptors that always seem to kind of crop up are that it smells, obviously, you know, a bit dungy, depending on how refined it is and how old it is, but it smells, and it's got a real musky animal quality to it. It smells of the ocean. There are pieces that smell really kind of briny and ozone-y, like they almost bring to mind like real wide open spaces, like kind of windswept coastal plains. You can really smell that sometimes in pieces of ambergris. Other people describe it as smelling like tobacco and polished wood and hay and soil and all that kind of really kind of elemental, you know, really earthy smells.
And part of the reason it's valuable in perfume, besides what it would contribute to the scent of something, is that it makes other elements that are added to a fragrance last a really long time.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that is essentially the reason that it's been used as a component of perfumes for, you know, maybe even longer than 1,000 years. Certainly the records go back 1,000 years. And, you know, it's one of those discoveries that is kind of lost to the mist of time, really. Who first discovered that it had that effect on fragrances, and how did they discover it? And that's just that's something that I don't think we'll ever know. But yes, basically, because of its molecular composition, it's, you know, very cholesterol-rich, very fatty, and so that makes it very stable and non-volatile. So what it does in a perfume when dissolved in alcohol is it binds to the fragrance molecules, and then it makes them stick around longer on the wearer's skin, basically. So, you know, what I tell people is we've all had this experience where you buy a cheap perfume or a cheap cologne and you spray it on, and within an hour it's like you never applied it at all. You just can't smell it. There's no trace of it. And those are those cheap perfumes that don't have any good fixatives in them. The fragrance just kind of evaporates and is gone in an instant, pretty much. And that is what ambergris was added to prevent, basically.
I'm fascinated that over the years there have been numerous attempts to synthesize something chemically very like the properties of ambergris, and they all tend to fall a little bit short of the real thing.
Yeah, that's true, and you know there's a good reason for that. So, the active compound in ambergris is a molecule called ambrene, and it's ironically enough odorless. But that compound goes through all these. It's a process of molecular degradation where the structure of the molecules change. You know, they're broken down and they're kind of snipped, and molecules are added to it in one place and removed from another place. And they eventually become a compound called naphthofuran, that's what's really the ambergris oxide. That is the actual compound that smells like ambergris and has that fixative quality to it. And that's the substance that chemists have tried for 100 years or so and managed to actually synthesize. So that's available, and that's what a lot of modern perfumers or perfumers who are trying to save a bit of money, that's what they would use, this naphthofuran compound. But that doesn't really get to the odor of ambergris itself, because ambergris is actually like a bouquet of all those different degradation compounds that are produced along the way. And it's really interesting if you actually look at the molecular shapes of them, and there's one compound that smells like tobacco, and then you change its structure a little bit through that degradation process, and then it smells like seawater. And then it undergoes another really subtle change, and it smells like mold and feces. And so that's why those are the descriptors that people often use when they're trying to describe ambergris. And that's why that synthetic effort at it, that naphthofuran, kind of gets at the essence of it but misses the completeness of it, if you like. It doesn't have any of those, that range of degradation products that kind of bring to mind all of those strange smells that people describe in the odor profile of ambergris if they ever get to handle and smell it.
My guest is Christopher Kemp. He's a molecular biologist and science writer. His new book is called Floating Gold, A Natural and Unnatural History of Ambergris. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Christopher Kemp. He's a molecular biologist and science writer, and he's got a new book out called Floating Gold, A Natural and Unnatural History of Ambergris. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Chris, it's one thing to imagine the first person who picked up a lump of this stuff, gave it a sniff, and thought, this might be interesting in a perfume. It's another thing to imagine the first human being who decided to take a nibble out of it. But people have been doing this for a long time, too.
It's true, yeah. People have been eating ambergris for hundreds of years. And, you know, I wondered when I was researching the book and I was coming across all these kind of really old and kind of sophisticated sounding recipes, I just started to wonder, is it because it tastes really good, or is it because it's valuable? You know, people, it's like a status symbol. Did people eat it just because they could?
Like the shark fin of the 17th century.
Yeah. Or, you know, back in the Tudor times in England, people used to eat things that were covered in gold and all kinds of stuff. I mean, a strange and difficult to obtain an ingredient as possible, basically. And so, yeah, I was really interested to try and find out whether ambergris fit into the category of really delicious or, unnecessary additive. And then on top of that, of course, you know, it's been famed for its tonic qualities and for its medicinal qualities. You know, it's supposed to provide a real pick-me-up and make people feel great. So I was interested to kind of explore all of those things.
And so in a really legendary example of gonzo journalism, you found this cookbook, right, from 1685?
Yeah, I did. And, I tried a few things, actually. There were some recipes that were just too strange for me to try. You know, carp that were drenched in ambergris and I think there was one recipe for tiny birds like sparrows or birds like that that had been drenched in ambergris too, and those were a little kind of unobtainable for me, out of my league. But so I did try a couple of recipes. One was this really strange it almost reminded me of a ravioli. Really, that's the recipe from 1685. It was kind of a pastry. And the filling of it was marrow meat with lots of spices like cinnamon and allspice and raisins and a bunch of ambergris in there too. And so I tried that and was not too impressed by that. The truth. That's one that I don't think I'd repeat or suggest to anyone else to repeat.
Could you taste the stuff? Could you tell what was the ambergris?
That recipe just didn't work on numerous levels. And I really think that, what I found was through the cooking process, a lot of the contents of the pastry actually kind of leached out, and I didn't find anything in there at all. And so I scratched that, and then I tried a couple of different things where I knew that the ambergris would stick around and would be more kind of evident. And so one recipe that I tried was scrambled eggs with ambergris shaved over the top with a microplane, almost like a
truffle.
Like a truffle, and it almost resembled black pepper, mm-hmm. fresh black pepper. And that was a favorite recipe of Charles II, who was, of course, an English monarch in the 17th century. And so I kept on coming across that, this suggestion that eggs and ambergris was Charles II's favorite dish, and he would eat it all the time. So I thought that I should try and have a go at that, and I did. And you could definitely sense the ambergris there, because it was almost as if the warmth of the eggs kind of really activated all of those odors of ambergris. Excuse me. Because ambergris is very sensitive to heat, and it melts, actually. And so as I was shaving it onto the piping hot eggs, it was kind of melting and producing this really odorous cloud. And that one, that was edible. It was clearly edible. But I'm not sure it added anything to the eggs, really, apart from the suggestion that I was wealthy and sophisticated enough to put ambergris on my eggs. And then the other recipe I tried was to add crushed ambergris to some hot cocoa. And that one didn't work too much either because it just stuck to my teeth and became like this black, slimy stuff that I couldn't get off. I couldn't get it off. I had to go and brush my teeth several times. So
I've got to hand it to you that you tried it not once, not twice, but three times.
I know. I don't know if that... I don't know what that says about me. It worries me sometimes. But, yeah, you know, I really thought that one of the things that... One of the reasons I wrote the book in general was because there was so little out there on ambergris, and what was out there seemed to all conflict with each other. There were so many different versions of the truth. And, you know, I always feel that... it's almost as if once something enters the print world, it becomes true to someone. I mean, if you read it and that's the only thing you've read, then that's the truth. And I was really concerned by the lack of real truth, you know, something that had a consensus to it. And so I felt like I wouldn't be doing justice to the project if I didn't try and learn about ambergris in every dimension, and that, unfortunately for me, included eating it.
So you mentioned that it melts pretty easily, and this is turned out to be sort of a red herring in the find of apparent ambergris that turned out not to be the case, that really got you obsessed with this topic in the first place. Tell us about that, about what happened on this beach in New Zealand.
Yeah, so I was living in New Zealand and working there as a scientist. It was... it was September of 2008, and my wife and I had moved to a town called Dunedin, which is way down on the, it's quite near to the southern tip of the South Island, and it's a really remote and rainy and windswept kind of place. And one night I turned on the news, and there was this segment, excuse me, about this enormous mystery object that had washed ashore on a beach called Breaker Bay near Wellington. And Wellington is the capital city of New Zealand, so it's a large metropolitan center. And so it seemed kind of incongruous that on a what amounts to pretty much a city beach with joggers and people strolling their kids and dogs, there was this enormous object. And it was it weighed an estimated half ton. It was about the size of one of those 44-gallon drums, and kind of the shape of that too. It was almost cylindrical, and it just sat there on the sand. And people began to make suggestions as to what it was, and someone had suggested maybe that it was an enormous boulder of brie that had washed ashore, and someone else said it was an asteroid from space, and then someone must have suggested that perhaps it was ambergris. And with that, a crowd of 100 or so people descended onto the beach, armed with shovels, all kinds of tools and implements, and started hacking the object up to try and claim a piece of it. Mm-hmm. And I just sat watching this kind of astonished by a couple of things, really. One, that as a biologist who is... you know, really interested in the natural world, that I'd never heard of ambergris at that time, but that whatever it was a product of the natural world because it had just washed ashore. And two, whatever it was, it made people act in the strangest way. And, you know, I just sat there watching a group of students carving a big piece of it off and using a bedsheet as an improvised sling to try and get it home. Hmm. And other people were stuffing pieces into plastic bags. And at that moment, I just thought, I have to know more. You know, I was sitting in view of the sea at that time, so I was interested on several levels. But one was, you know, could I find a piece of ambergris worth $50,000 just down the road where the road met the sea. And, you know, that question kind of is what took me on the, or is at least what began the journey for me.
And you have now spent a lot of time combing beaches hoping to find a lump of this stuff. And it seems like, in many cases, the greatest component of a find is just really good luck.
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's good luck. You know, often some of the finds that make it to the media, the ones that are reported on by newspapers, are pure accidental people stumbling over these big, stinky boulders of something, and for some reason having the presence of mind to stick it in the back of the car.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no planning for that. But at the same time, I would say that, you know, I talk about in the book the whole the culture of ambergris collecting, and that in certain places where it's more common, people make their full-time profession and from looking for it, and those people would certainly say there's no luck involved. They know the prime weather conditions, they know the best places to look for it, they know the best time of day. They're very territorial and secretive. They guard their patch pretty fiercely, and to them there's absolutely no luck involved at all. It's a science.
And they train dogs to go look for this stuff.
They do, yeah. I was told that a good ambergris dog takes about a year to train. And, you know, that's a huge bonus for anyone looking for ambergris, because the dogs have speed on their side, obviously. They have that incredibly sensitive nose. They're able to find any ambergris on the beach, but they're also able to find any that has been buried in the sand. And they, you know, I've spoken with ambergris collectors who have dogs that find the smallest pieces for them buried in dunes.
Hmm. Sure, there's got to be a lot of it that washed ashore and nobody found it at the time.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So talk about the first people to really try and study this stuff. In particular, the personal physician of Cotton Mather is a fascinating case.
Yeah, so his name was Zabdiel Boylston, and he was a young physician in Boston. And he was really taken with ambergris. And this was in the 1720s, about. And at that point, it was still a complete mystery as to precisely where ambergris came from. There were all sorts of competing theories, and the only thing that they all seemed to have in common was that they were pretty silly. There were theories that that ambergris was the liver of a certain species of fish, or that it was a species of mushroom that grew on the seafloor and was dislodged by storms and then floated to the surface. There was another theory that it was a subterranean fat that was produced kind of in the bowels of the earth and expelled into the ocean by underground canals. I mean, there were all these theories, and no one really had any sense of where it actually came from. And then Zabdiel Boylston was around at the time that that the sperm whale fishery was becoming really active in Massachusetts and New England, and he happened to be around when some whalers first discovered that that ambergris was actually contained within the intestines of a sperm whale. And he reported that. But even then, when he reported it, he was very cagey about it, and he wasn't willing to say that sperm whales produced the ambergris. He was only, as a good scientist, I would say, he was only willing to say that this particular sperm whale and several others that the whalers had killed had ambergris inside them, and to conclude from that what one may. But I think that, most people would consider that first report, which is just a very, you know, very concise, doesn't beat around the bush. It's a one-page report in the journal Philosophical Transactions. That's the first time that people can categorically say they knew where ambergris came from.
So the stuff has been traded by to the world's top perfumers for a long time now. How do they select the pieces that they want to purchase and use?
Well, so what I've been told by several other people, and what has been written about in other books before, is that some of the real large perfumers like Chanel and Guerlain would actually employ a nose, you know, someone whose sole job it is to assess ambergris on the market and to buy it. And that person would really be an ambergris specialist, if you like. They would be able to look at a piece and assess its value and its quality and whether or not it's the kind of material that they would want for their perfumes. And I did actually locate one of those people who works for Chanel, but they were, as were so many other people in the research of the book, unwilling to talk to me about ambergris.
Did that take you by surprise? Even in one case where you called a dad whose son had found a lump of this stuff, he was really very cagey.
Yeah, he was actually quite surly, I'd say. You know, it's more, it goes more than cagey. It's real suspicion and kind of a muscular aggression, really. It did surprise me. When I started researching the whole subject of ambergris, I, you know, made a kind of a list of the type of people I would want to talk with, marine biologists and people who had been reported in the news media as having found ambergris, and traders. And none of them really were willing to speak with me. Hmm. I was surprised time and again by that.
Christopher Kemp is with us. He's a molecular biologist and science writer. His new book is called Floating Gold, A Natural and Unnatural History of Ambergris. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science writer and molecular biologist Christopher Kemp, whose new book is called Floating Gold, A Natural and Unnatural History of Ambergris. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Chris, for hundreds of years, it seems the human race did its level best to drive sperm whales into extinction. Now we're doing what we can to preserve their populations, to the extent that in many places, including the United States, it's illegal to pick up ambergris even off a beach. First of all, does that do anything to actually protect the safety of the sperm whale population, as far as you've been able to ascertain?
I don't think it does. You know, I think it's... I think that regulations like that are more symbolic than anything else. It's a case of protecting the whales by regulations like the Marine Mammal Protection Act that prevents any kind of harming of them. And I think that at the time that those regulations were being drawn up, they didn't want to weaken some of the most important aspects of them by passing out every last thing about whales and every last piece of the whale. Mm-hmm. And so they just said anything that came from a whale or any piece of a whale is protected under them. And so that's certainly the case in the US and in a few other countries too. In Australia it's also illegal. But in most countries in the world, trade of it is not really regulated at all.
And so it seems as if, I mean, you'd be crazy to want to follow the law based on the value of the stuff. How is it, in terms of the grades, how expensive can it get?
It can so the finest, most refined white ambergris, which is the stuff that smells, it even smells refined. You know, the black fresh stuff is very aggressive and stinky, and the white stuff has a much more subtle smell to it. You can tell it's higher quality just by holding it, and that goes for something in the region of maybe $1,000 a pound or a little more.
Hmm.
But having said that, you know, at that really fine refined ambergris, it's hard to even put a price on it. If you had a piece and it was just really good quality, I think that people would be willing to pay even more than that for it. But the market price, if you will, is about $1,000 a pound.
Wow. And so how much of it does it take to go into, say, a bottle of perfume that's an ounce or something?
Well, I don't think you'd need very much at all. I mean, what people tend to do is they make tinctures of ambergris. They grind it up with a pestle and mortar,
mm-hmm.
and they dissolve it into alcohol, and then that alcohol forms the base of the perfume. And people experiment with all different quantities, but you know, you read recipes, like perfume recipes, for maybe 1% or 3% ambergris tinctures. And so that's not very much, but you certainly get into thinking about really large quantities of ambergris when you think about kind of high-output companies like Chanel that might be using it, and they would be making thousands and thousands of bottles of perfume with it instead of just small-batch fragrances.
So what sort of adventures did you undertake in your search for a piece of your own?
Well, I went initially, because I was based in New Zealand, I went pretty much the length and breadth of the country in search of ambergris. We were very lucky in that my wife and I were working there for a couple of years. And in that time, I would go out all the time. My son was born there, and in his first couple of years, I would say, we pretty much exclusively spent our free time on the local coastline looking for ambergris. And that's, you know, as he learned to walk, he pretty much learned to... My technique for seeing if I'd found ambergris was to pick up objects that I couldn't readily identify and kind of give them a smell,
mm-hmm.
and... you know, toss them away if they didn't really smell of anything. And by the time he was 18 months old, my son was able to pick objects up and smell them and say, nope, even though he didn't really know what he was looking for,
mm-hmm.
he'd seen me do it enough times. And so the length and breadth of New Zealand, and then I went to a small island called Stewart Island, which is about 20 miles south of New Zealand in the Southern Seas, where that's traditionally been kind of a hotspot for ambergris, and everyone who lives on the island knows about it. And that's a really unusual place, because it's one of those islands that almost no one has ever really heard of, but there are 350 stout-hearted full-time residents who live there all the year round, mm. and just kind of clinging on to life there, really. Old fishing families and that kind of thing. And so... spent a week or so there, and that was really enjoyable. Spent some time on Cape Cod and visiting Harvard and seeing a small kind of aging, crumbling collection of ambergris samples that they have there. Went to New Bedford Whaling Museum in search of some pieces and some records there. They have an enormous collection of whaling logbooks from that era, and you can kind of... they've all been catalogued really well, so you can look up a specific term like ambergris and then go to the logbooks that mention it, and you can read about certain discoveries of ambergris there during the whaling era. So, yeah, I went on a lot of journeys and basically spent a lot of time trudging through the rain, picking up objects, hoping they were ambergris.
And you've got to sort of kiss a lot of frogs in a process like that.
You do. Yeah, that's a very nice way to put it. Yeah. I mean, the only real thing to do, because ambergris can look it's almost impossible to categorically say what it looks like. You know, it can be anywhere between black and white, so it can kind of be gray and green and yellow and speckled and mottled. And so the only real thing you can do is just walk along the high tide line where all the flotsam gathers in a big drift and kind of tease your way through it, dividing everything into the things that you can identify pretty easily and the things that you can't, and those things could be ambergris.
We have an email here from Mark in Irving who says, if it's illegal to pick it up on U.S. beaches, that would imply U.S. beachgoers probably don't recognize it for what it is. Do folks tend to confuse it with some type of hydrocarbon tarball or mat?
Yeah, that's a good point. They probably do. I think that certainly the fresher ambergris could probably be confused for some kind of tarball, because that even will melt in direct sunlight into kind of a black sticky mess. You know, certainly in terms of the regulations surrounding ambergris, it's just a really, it's a real tangled mess, mm-hmm. because it's definitely illegal, and I wouldn't want to suggest otherwise to your listeners. But I also know that there are thousands of people who are kind of home perfumers, if you like. There's a real community of people who are making perfume in their own homes, in their kitchens, and they all are able to buy ambergris online from vendors and traders in New Zealand and other places, and certainly that sale is not very well regulated. So it's one of those things where it's illegal. It has been for 40 years, and I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. But there are very few people out there who can easily identify ambergris. And so, you know, if you buy some online and get it shipped to you, I'm not quite sure how that sale would be prevented. And that's how a lot of those sales go through. It's not actively regulated in that way. But, you know, it's one of those regulations that could be revisited at any time, and they could change the law around it. It's certainly one of the reasons it's prohibited is because it's not considered a waste product, because there's some confusion, or there has been in the past, about how it's produced. And now that the book is out there and is providing some more hard scientific data about how it's produced and how it's actually probably expelled like feces, there is a chance that they would change those regulations too.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Howard on the line in Dallas. Hi, Howard.
Hello. I was just wondering if your guest has run into anyone actually trying, I guess throughout history, trying to make an actual love potion or something like that out of ambergris, I guess mixed with other things, sandalwood, I guess things like that.
Chris, did you hear any love potions?
I did, yeah. I mean, you know, throughout history, it was used as an aphrodisiac. And I'm sure there are recipes, if you go into, like, the older archives from, you know, the, I would say, 1700s to 1900s, you could probably find some recipes out there. It was definitely used as a tonic and aphrodisiac. But I only went so far. I only went so far in my use of it.
So unlike a lot of authors, you actually share your email address in the book. I can't imagine the kinds of responses you've heard from people now that you are sort of one of the world's experts on this substance.
Yeah, you know, I really was eager to do that. And it was something that I asked the publishers to do, and they kind of hemmed and hawed about it to begin with and said that it wasn't really the type of thing that they usually did. But I really wanted it to maybe begin a conversation. Mm-hmm. I knew that there would be some people who would say that that some of the things that I was saying in the book were incorrect. And rather than have people kind of steaming at home and ripping pages out, I wanted them to be able to email me and vent to me instead. And then I also wanted people to never be in that position that I was in, where I was trying to find information and just felt like I had, you know, fallen into a rabbit hole. I wanted people to have a source. And so it's been a lot of fun. You know, I've had a lot of people write and tell me how much they enjoy the book. I've had people send me photos of strange objects and ask if it's ambergris. I've had folks from the Maldives tell me that ambergris is washing ashore more this summer than any year they can remember.
Hmm.
I have an Irish friend called Pat who emails me on a weekly basis these photos of just really awful looking things, asking me if he should pick them up and take them home. And I always say, no, Pat, leave it there. And then half an hour later, he'll send me another picture of this same object on a sheet of newspaper in his house. He's completely ignored me, and I don't think he's found ambergris yet, but I feel like he will because he picks up everything.
That's a lot of responsibility for you to be the arbiter of Pat's ambergris discoveries.
True, yeah, but it's a lot of fun because it gives you some kind of a sense of who's reading the book, whether they really get it, whether they understand it, and whether or not it's kind of urged them to go out to the coast and look for ambergris themselves, which was my real hope for the book.
It's a nice place to spend time, if nothing else.
That's true, yeah.
Did you ever find a piece for yourself? Maybe you don't want to say because
yeah,
let's
say no comment.
All right. Talk about this. You did come upon some that was for sale that you really, really, really wanted but couldn't afford.
Yeah. So that was a piece that I ended up meeting a trader called Adrian Buse, who's one of the most kind of active and high-profile ambergris traders in New Zealand. And I met her in a hotel room in Auckland. And it was all very clandestine, you know. She didn't want me to take pictures of her or tape the conversation or anything. But she unpacked thousands of dollars worth of ambergris onto the table in front of me and let me just kind of work my way through it all and smell it and handle it. And there was a piece there that that really smelled as if you had somehow distilled the ocean and everything about the coastline and just had it in this one lump. It was like solid ocean, if you like. Mm. It smelled of that brininess that you start to smell when you're a couple of blocks from the ocean. You've been driving all day to get there. And I just so wanted to buy it, but couldn't afford it.
Christopher Kemp is a molecular biologist and science writer. His new book is called Floating Gold, A Natural and Unnatural History of Ambergris. Chris, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. To learn more about Think, you can go online to kera.org/think, where you can also download the free daily podcast. If you've got a question or a comment or a suggestion for the show, send those along to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.